happens probably about three times a year, where I am to officiate a funeral service, and I show up here to officiate the funeral service, and I'm coming in this door, or the door that used to be there. It's a dream that started before the renovation, obviously. The door that used to be there, and everybody is leaving the funeral I'm supposed to officiate. I'm late, and everyone is upset and mad at me and won't talk to me, but it's one of those reoccurring dreams, and when I have it and I wake up, I start wondering, do I have a funeral that's not on my schedule that I don't know about? Maybe it's stress from work or home that causes you to lose sleep that dominates your thoughts. Maybe it's worry over your children or your grandchildren or worry over your aging parents. Maybe we worry over holidays. I don't know if over Thanksgiving you worried about the turkey being just right, or if you worried about some new recipe that you were going to try out on Thanksgiving Day, or you worried that you're really red uncle and your really blue daughter would start a political conversation that would end in chaos. Did you lose sleep over it? Well, now that we've just passed one major holiday, the next one is just a month away from today, and we might worry. There's so much to plan, there's so much to buy, there's so much to bake, to do before the next big day arrives. Now, sometimes it's excitement for that big day that causes us to lose some sleep, right? I remember as a child, the hardest night of the year to go to sleep on was Christmas Eve. But a lot of times, we just worry because we're so busy, and it causes us to lose sleep. And instead of focusing on celebrating the upcoming birthday of King Jesus, the King of Kings, we focus on ourselves and all that we have to do. And trust me, as a pastor, I share in this burden, because when the season of Advent rolls around next Sunday, pastors enter into one of the busiest seasons of the year. And I'm sure Scott and Froda would tell you the same thing from the music ministries department. There's so much to attend to. There are so many things to check off the list to make sure that all things are covered. But the truth is, we live in a culture that has an addiction to being busy. Writing in the New York Times, Tom Kreider observed that so many people speak of how busy they are that some people even use the term crazy busy. You ever heard that phrase or use that phrase? I'm crazy busy. And he knows that almost everyone I know is busy. They feel anxious and guilty when they aren't either working or doing something to promote their work. They schedule in time with friends the way students with 4.0 GPAs make sure to sign up for community service because it looks good on their college applications. And Kreider says many people are addicted to busyness and dread what they might have to face in its absence. In other words, just as busyness creates stress in our lives, we also lose sleep over the lack of busyness because we're worried about what's not getting done. So here's an important question. If we're going to lose sleep, what should we really be losing sleep over? What's so important that we should really be losing sleep over? Now, I'm certain that the King David lost sleep over many things in his life. I'm certain that that point in time when Saul wanted to kill him, that would be something to lose sleep over when the king that you serve is wanting to kill you. I'm sure the whole scandal with Bathsheba caused him to lose sleep, and then sending her husband Uriah to the front line so that he would be killed caused him to lose sleep. I'm certain that when his son Absalom attempted to usurp him from the throne, that he lost sleep then as well. And I'm also certain that as the king of God's people, he had other instances where the business and the busyness of being king caused him to lose sleep. But here in Psalm 132, we see David's heart, mind, and focus at its finest as he is losing sleep over the right thing. David swore this oath: I will not enter my house or go to my bed. I will allow no sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids till I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling for the Mighty One of Jacob. Now, this psalm is one of the oldest psalms in the Bible. As a matter of fact, it was Jewish tradition tells us that when the temple was finally built, King Solomon's temple was built, that this psalm was sung at the dedication of the temple. But it's also a psalm that's included in what's known as the songs of ascent. They were songs that Jewish people sang as they made their pilgrimage from all over Palestine to Jerusalem to make their way to the temple to worship God. And so it's also known as a pilgrimage song because these pilgrims made their way and they would make their way up Jerusalem, ascending Mount Zion and going for one of the great annual worship festivals of Passover or the Festival of First Fruits or the Festival of Tabernacles. And so this psalm is remembering, it's about remembering King David's passionate commitment to God and his longing for God's presence. So what is Psalm 132 all about? It's all about remembering. I like the way that Eugene Peterson in the Message translation translates verse 6 through 8 of Psalm 132. He says this: remember how we got the news in Ephrathah, learned all about it in J.R. Meadows. We shouted, let's go worship at God's own footstool. Up, God, enjoy your new place of quiet repose, you and your mighty covenant ark. Now, if you'll remember, the Ark of the Covenant was made under the supervision of Moses, and it was a symbol of God's presence among his people. It was a box that was about 45 inches long and 27 inches broad and 27 inches deep, and it was constructed with wood and it was overlaid with gold. Its lid of solid gold was called the mercy seat, and there were two cherubim, angel-like figures at either end that framed the space around the central mercy seat from which God's word was heard. And the ark was built while God's people were at Mount Sinai in the wilderness. And there Moses not only received the Ten Commandments, Moses also received all the other laws, and he also received instructions on how to build the ark and also how to build the tabernacle, the tent in which the ark was placed. This ark had accompanied Israel through their wilderness wanderings, and it had been kept in for them as they made their way into the promised land, the conquest of the promised land, and it had been kept in Shiloh from the time of that conquest. But then the Israelites, they lost a battle to their enemies, the Philistines. And when the Philistines won the battle, they captured the ark and they used the ark like a war trophy. But the problem was is that they didn't know how to care for the ark. And because they didn't know how to care for the ark, there were curses that came upon the Philistines. And they didn't want it anymore. And after 7 months, the Philistines returned the ark to the Israelites, and it ended up in the village of Kiriath Jearim, where it rested until David came to get it some 20 years later and place it in a place of honor in Jerusalem, where it later became enshrined in Solomon's temple. Now, the history of the ark for the Hebrews was kind of a theological handbook for them. It provided an account of the presence of God among his people, and its history showed the importance of having God with you, but also the danger of trying to carry around God and to use God for your own purposes. And so the ark itself was important in that it emphasized that God was with his people and that God was over and above his people because God quite obviously cannot be put in a box. The ark was the symbol and not the reality. Now, David had not been the official king for very long when news had come to David of where the ark was, and he vowed to get it, and he was obedient to his vow. Now, we have to say that under Saul's leadership as king, the Lord had been pushed to the margins. But David wanted the Lord to be front and center, so he gathered his people to himself, and he said, let's go to his dwelling place. Let's go worship at his footstool, saying, arise, Lord, and come to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. And so he went up to get the ark, and he brought it in a festive parade to Jerusalem. 2 Samuel tells us that David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and sound of trumpets. As this old ark song, Psalm 132, is being sung now by those pilgrims making their way to Jerusalem, they have these memories that are being revived and relived. Because as they make their way, as they ascend their slope, these slopes on their way to worship God on Mount Zion in the temple, they know that others had made that pilgrimage before. Up these same roads, along these same paths, the ark had been carried and accompanied by a determined and expectant people. They remembered David's obedience and his passion for a place for the Lord, the mighty one of Israel. Now, why is this so important to us? Because during the holiday season, we easily develop memory problems. And memory problems lead to obedience problems. You know, we wonder why King Saul did not bother to find the Ark of the Covenant when he became king, even though it had been missing for almost two decades when he became king. Was he too busy being king that he couldn't look for it? Were there too many things to tend to make room for the true king of heaven and earth in his life and in the life of the people? Was he too busy worrying about David's success in battles and wanting to take out David that he worried and in that busy worriedness of his life that he had memory problems? You know, busyness leads to frantic memory problems. Have you ever been so busy and consumed that you leave something behind? And when you figure out that you've left it behind, you can't remember where you placed it? Your keys, your wallet, your phone, the grocery store list. The grocery store list is in your phone. Now problems are compounded. You can't remember where you parked your car. I've had days when I've been in the Wesley building where my office is, and I've been so busy at the end of the day, I can't remember whether I'm supposed to exit the building on Highland Street or go to the parking lot north of the Wesley building. Can't remember where I put my car. Thankfully, I don't have to go that far to figure out. Or maybe you've just been so busy that you've just left Jesus behind. You can't remember where you put him. I can't remember where I dropped him off, where I left him. I've been losing sleep over so many things that I, like Saul, have left Jesus with the Philistines, and then I left him at Kiriath-Jearim. And it's not been 20 years, but it certainly feels like it. Because I've been losing sleep over my own agenda. And when we lose sleep over our agenda, we are obviously outside of God's agenda. We need to adopt David's passionate obedience. I will allow no sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids till I find a place for the Lord. So is there a place for the Lord in your life? Today in the liturgical calendar of the Christian year is Christ the King Sunday. It's actually in the liturgical calendar of the Christian year. This is the final Sunday of the Christian year. The new year starts next week with the first Sunday of Advent. And one of the great things about Christ the King Sunday is that it reminds us that Christ is the King of all ages, that he was the King of last year, he's going to be the King of the next year, and he's King forever and ever and ever. And so next Sunday, we begin a new year, and Christ is still King with the beginning of Advent. And you know, when we begin a new year, what do we like to do? We like to re-up. We like to refocus. We like to renew. We like to recommit, all those re-things. And what if it is a time for us for recommitment to find a place for the Lord? Right here, right now. And what could be the busiest season, what if we made a commitment that we will make for the main focus of our lives, finding a place for the Lord? You know, our history, our common memory as Christ followers is that the true temple is not one that's made by human hands, but is the dwelling place of God in Jesus Christ. If you remember John 1:14, it tells us that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Actually, the Greek term for that is that he tented or tabernacled among us. Remember, the tabernacle is what Moses built, that had built that would house the Ark of the Covenant. And so Jesus has tabernacled among us, the very presence of God. It is in him that all the purposes of the temple and the ark are brought to fulfillment, that the annual pilgrimages that people made to Jerusalem, it is now clear, was but a pointer to an even greater pilgrimage, not merely the pilgrimage to an earthly Zion, as great as that was, but a pilgrimage out of the life of sin and death and into abundant life. As Tim and Julie Tennant point out, Jesus is the new temple where God's presence dwells. Through repentance and faith, the people of God, since all fullness of the deity dwelled in bodily form, we come to Christ, God's great mercy seat. Jesus is both King and temple. But how do I make room for the King? What kind of holy habits make room for the King? I thought about this week when I saw on, I don't remember if it was a Facebook post or Instagram post from the church, where it said that our Genesis campus was in desperate need of coats for people who are cold this winter. And I thought about, that's where we meet the King, one of the ways where we make place for the King. And my mind was immediately drawn to Matthew 25, where Jesus says this. He says, then the King, that's Jesus, then the King will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. And then a few verses down, it says, the King will reply, truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. We make room for the King when we make room for people who are in need, people who need to be clothed, people who are hungry and thirsty and strangers and need to be visited. I remember several years ago when when our children were younger, that our family and the Thorntons, Chris and Keisha Thornton, and their children were younger, same age as our children, and we decided we were just going to go to a nursing home and visit people who were lonely and sing Christmas carols. It was a perfect match for me. I can't sing. They couldn't hear. It was beautiful. Why is it that we will busy our lives with just one more Christmas party and finding just one more, just the right present, our we'll have make room for one more charge on our debit card or credit card, or we'll buy just one more ugly holiday sweater and make room in our closet. Why is it that we can make room for that, yet we are too busy for one more person who needs food and who needs a drink and who needs clothes and who needs a friend and who needs a visit? And Jesus says, when we make room for the least of these, we've made room for Him, Christ, our King. I think that's why the most important decoration to me at Christmas is not a tree, it's not lights, but it's the nativity. Because the most vulnerable creature in the scene of the nativity is the King of Kings, a little baby born in a cave in Bethlehem. You know, our world needs to know our King, who loves and transforms and lifts up and makes room for us, who lays down His life for us. But our world will only know our King if His people are not too busy for Him. He is the true King, from year to year, from age to age, to be worshipped and given the place at the very center of our lives. Thanks be to God for Christ, our King. May we not be too busy for Him. Amen. I want to invite you to stand as you're able as we sing our